The views, information, or opinions expressed during Angel Answers with Amy Toys series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily are the opinions of those of the host, BBS Radio, and its affiliates and its producers. The show, its host, BBS Radio, and affiliates and its producers are not responsible and does not verify the accuracy of any of the information contained in the series. The primary purpose of this series is to educate and inform. This series does not constitute medical, legal, or other professional advice or services. The series is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any portion of this series may not be copied, reproduced, or edited without written consent by the host or its producer. And good evening and welcome to Angel Answers with Amy Toy. I am a clairvoyant, clairsentient, and everything else in the world, if you want to say it that way. And I have a very special author on today. Her name is Eileen Workman, and she has a very background in, she's from, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, she graduated from Whittier College with a bachelor's degree in political science and minor in economics, history, and biology. And she has spent 16 years in the financial services industry as a senior VP and financial advisor for Smith Barney. After experiencing a profound spiritual awakening in 2007, Ms. Workman left the financial services industry and dedicated herself to writing her first book, Sacred Economics, The Currency of Life, as a means of inviting us to question our longstanding assumptions about the nature of capitalism. Her book places particular focus on the more destructive aspects of late-stage corporatism. And now in her new book, which is a lovely book, by the way, listeners, Raindrops of Love for a Thirsty World. Ms. Workman's second nonfiction offering is a great book which summons the wisdom of the life force that flows within all of us and invites it to speak with us in its own words. The book inspires a healthy sense of self-love in the reader in order to propel them beyond suffering and into the fullest, most beautiful expression of themselves. Welcome, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I hope I didn't kill your college.
Is it Whittier? No, you said it right.
Okay. I'm reading this. I'm like, oh, my God. How are you today, Eileen? It's a pleasure to have you on. It seems like you have both left and right brain thinking going on here, being in the financial services world, now into the spiritual realm, if you will, especially with this lovely book, Raindrops of Love.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I feel like that's something that I've been working to balance well within myself, is that masculine and feminine energy, and that's what the book is actually about as well.
That's excellent. And, I mean, what do you feel is the promise that it makes with the book? Let's just go into the questions, and sometimes I do go off the questions, too, just because things come to me.
Well, the purpose of the book, the reason that it came into being was a consequence of my own inner exploration. And, you know, I had realized for quite some time that the things that I had been taught to believe about reality didn't appear to be the truth of the reality that I was experiencing. And that led me to some deep frustration and some questioning and, you know, just a lot of discomfort about the world. And I found that when I allowed myself to ask a really deep question and grow still, there was a higher voice of wisdom that flowed through me from within me that actually triggered multiple realizations within me that were almost shocking. So I knew it wasn't like my local personality that was contributing this wisdom. It came from a deeper place that was more cosmically universal. And I think my experience was that I had access to that whenever I opened that door through stillness and sincere inquiry. And I believe it's available to all of us. So if there is a purpose to the book, it is to invite everyone who is a reader or interested to go inside themselves and find that on their own portal to that higher wisdom. I believe it's universal.
Yes, it is. And that's why it's so important to do not only prayer but meditation, so we can tap into that divine flow and we can have those experiences as you had with this book. Now, I find it interesting that you said you credit the book Life as the book's author rather than name yourself. Can you say more about that source of the information where you gleaned from the book and how others might get in touch with it, this that source too?
Yeah, because for me it was, I felt like it was received wisdom, and that the reason, you know, as I scribed it onto the page, it filtered through the local personality, Eileen Workman, who was able to bring it into language. But a lot of what I received was imagery and, you know, full multidimensional realizations that were nonlinear. I think that's the way the universe communicates. It doesn't necessarily communicate in linear language. It has a lot of ways of speaking with us.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I wanted people to be able to pick up the book and, as they read it, not feel like they were receiving information or insight from my local personality, but to really be able to read it and feel like the energy, the wisdom, the truth that was coming through the pages was coming directly from their own higher self. And to resonate with it that way. So that's why I credit it to Life, is because it really does feel like it didn't come from me, it came through me.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Isn't that cool? You're just the channel and you just write it out, and it's, do you think this is automatic writing for you?
In many ways it was, because often I would scribe something and then I would go back and read it and think, oh my gosh, that's powerful. That's brilliant. I had no idea. And I don't think you can amaze yourself if you're writing out of your own already established wisdom. There was something novel and beautiful about the process.
Yes, definitely. Yes, sometimes I'll do, like, I'll write something. I'm like, where did this come from? I'll blog. Where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't,
you know,
me.
That feeling.
I think you zone out after a while, too, when you write. If you're just zoning out. It's a different, I don't know, I can't explain it. Not in my perception, anyway. I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for me it's like an expansiveness where I'm almost not even present. There's just a witnessing observer consciousness that's pulling in the information and moving it to the page. But my personality is diminished so markedly that I'm not thinking about me at all when I'm writing that way.
Yeah, I know. You don't. You get the ego gets out of the way, and that's the great part of working with divine. It really, or divine, whatever you want to call God, divine, whatever, universal mind. Your book hints at the human journey. Can you tell us more about that?
I think what I'm coming to really appreciate, and this is a shift for me, because I was raised in a very traditional Christian household that perceived humanity, I was taught, you know, that we were broken and bad and wicked and cast away from God and all the traditional stories that were the early Old Testament biblical explanations for the suffering of humankind. And I think what I've come to really appreciate is to recontextualize our species in a different way and to see it as a movement, an evolution of consciousness that has carried us from species childhood into what I would say where we are now, which is late-stage species adolescence, as we stand on the threshold of species adulthood. And what that does for us as a species is very comparable to what an individual experiences moving through those phases. So what I would say the time of the Garden of Eden that the Bible speaks of would be species childhood, when we were completely innocent and completely trusting, and we were one with the universe, not in a thoughtful way. It was just the way we were birthed into it. We had an expectation that we would be taken care of and everything was fine, and the earth was our mother, and early humankind had that sort of matriarchal society with that established. My sense of it is that what we call the fall from grace was actually the birth of self-awareness, where suddenly we moved into this sort of adolescent way of perceiving ourselves as something separate or apart from Mother Earth, that we were bringing something unique and new to the table, and it was important for us to step away from that basically innocent connectedness in order to evaluate who we are and why we're here, which requires a certain separation, as is true for all adolescents, to discover yourself. And then you come back around with the quiet confidence of adulthood and reconnect, but at a different level, at a level of maturity that invites what I would consider almost a lover relationship with life. So we've gone from being the child of life to being the sort of recalcitrant bratty teen, and we're on our way back to consciously, willingly reconnecting with life as lovers at the same level of co-creative capacity to work with it. And so that's the transformation that I think is well underway within the species and what this book is supporting and encouraging in individuals that are ready.
That's a very interesting take on the Garden of Eden, by the way. I've never thought of it that way. That's a very insightful observation.
You know,
yes.
I think one of the important things to realize is that that story was told from the perspective of the baby bird that got shoved out of the nest because its parents were ready for it to fly, but it didn't know that it could. And so when it hit the ground and got a little bruised and battered, it figured it did something wrong. And that's kind of how we look at God. It's like God is up there away and threw us down. But we never would have been promoted to that process if we weren't ready for it. So we've had 7,000 to 10,000 years of adolescence in this sort of self-consciousness, which is like a hard seed. And in order for us to really put down roots in the universe as a full expression of life, we need to move into life awareness or life consciousness. And that's the transformation that I'm experiencing and that I know many, many other people are experiencing as well.
Yes, yours truly included.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are there specific exercises a person can do to ground this material more thoroughly in their own life?
Well, I think the primary message of the book is that it's crucial for us to recognize that as part of this transformation, we are in process of shifting from being a species that is told what to do by superior elements in our species, whether they're avatars or great teachers or gurus or demigods or whatever it is. They've always told us what to do and given us rule books. And I think what's happened over the past certainly several hundred years, if not thousand years, is that creation has speeded up. As more people are doing more things and are engaged with one another in more creative ways, we can't write new rules fast enough to tell everybody what to do. So we've reached a place of obsolescence in the way we were managing ourselves. And that requires us to decouple from the belief that we can find a better rule book or write a more thorough rule book that will give us all the answers we need on what to do in the world so we never make a mistake. And instead to go do this inner journey and discover how to be in the world. Because when I learn how to be in my own attitude, internal attitude toward life, I know what to do in relationship with whatever shows up. So if there is an exercise or a process, it's learning how to align one's own inner attitude so that the energy one expresses in the world is an energy or a frequency that empowers you to be fully present and alive with whatever is showing up in a way that empowers it to show up fully. And you can receive all the feedback that's out there so that anything that you then choose to do comes from that place of deep wisdom and deep relationship. So for me, the exercise that I use has to do, I connect it with these energy fields with the seven chakras. And from base to crown, I would say that for me the process is whenever I feel discomfort or anxiety or stress, fear, frustration, whatever it is I stop and I do a little check and I look and I say, okay, am I being, first of all, at the root chakra, am I being trusting? Do I trust myself? Do I trust the world? Am I open to new information and whatever feedback is coming in? am I allowing myself to be courageous in the face of the unknown because I'm confronting that constantly? Am I expressing or experiencing compassion for anything that appears to be suffering, struggling, confused, or in pain? Am I communicating in the throat chakra? Am I communicating kindly any message that I need to convey or feel compelled to convey in the moment? Mm-hmm. Am I being patient and receptive such that whatever is unfolding feels spacious enough to fully unfold before I respond? And above all, am I being peaceful in my encounter with whatever is showing up, as peaceful as I can be, because I know that whatever is showing up is just another aspect of the unified field in which I am. I'm also an aspect, so it's all connected. So that's my process.
Interesting. Very interesting. You know, because of the obsolescence of where we're going, how do you see humanity in the next upcoming years, like especially with regards to technology, and why do you feel that way?
Good question. Well, I think two things are happening. I think, you know, part of the juvenile approach, the adolescent approach, is that as teenagers, we tend to want a lot of freedom and no responsibility. That's the impulse. Give me freedom. Give me freedom. Freedom for me as an individual, but I don't want any social responsibility or collective responsibility. You know, a teenager wants to be able to take the car and go wherever they want and not worry about having to do chores or be part of the family dynamic. That's very typical. So that's the energy that's moving through our society today. I think where we're headed is into a higher dynamic where freedom and responsibility are reconnected. And we know that we, in order for us to claim additional freedom, in order to be self-mastery, to be in a place of self-mastery, we also have to take responsibility for our own self-actualization and discover how to bring forth the best in ourselves. Learning how to do that in a way that is life-affirming rather than life-negating or problematic for other is the challenge. Technology is delivering to us enormous capacity to do amazingly creative things. But at the same time, it also has a dark underbelly in that the power of the technology that we are bringing into the world also gives us the power to destroy ourselves if we're not thoughtful about how we're engaging with one another. So I think we're fast hitting a place where the decision has to be made as to how we are using technology to be more loving and life-affirming and creatively regenerative in the way that we're doing ourselves, rather than exploitive and damaging to the ecosystem and denigrating of one another. That's the direction that we're moving.
And going away from technology into the role of the masculine and the feminine, how is that relationship changing over time? Is there a way I can respond?
Well, yes. And here again, I think if we contextualize it in the framework of adolescence, we know that as individuals, when we move into adolescence, if we're boys, we get big hyper boosts of testosterone, which makes us bigger, stronger, more aggressive, more sexually alive and intense, and also perhaps sexually uncomfortable. And at the same time, when young women move into adolescence, they tend to get that burst of estrogen that moves them into this more sort of hormonal up and down period, and they become more introspective and potentially more insecure and quiet, a little bit more competitive and melodramatic with one another. So all those energies are what's moving through our society today. If you look at how people are relating, you see that playing out on the world stage. It's a massive play of adolescence, almost juvenile delinquency, that's happening on the world stage today.
Yes, I know. 45's tweets, that's all I have to say. Anyway.
There you go. So, you know, as we witness that, our role becomes not to denigrate the patriarchy, which has been running the society for thousands of years, or to undermine the power and the strength and the role of the masculine, but to uplift, elevate, and strengthen the feminine, which has been suppressed and has contributed, honestly, to its own suppression as part of that insecurity. It's time for the divine feminine to rise and take the rightful place beside the divine masculine as equal partners. That doesn't mean that the male has to be diminished in any way, but there is a fear, I think, on the masculine side that what we're saying is male bashing. And my perspective is, indeed, it's not that at all. It's actually marrying the mind, which is a masculine aspect of our interior, with the heart, which is the feminine aspect of our own interior, and learning how to balance those two so dynamically, masterfully, that the two become one in the way that we address the world.
Wow. Yes, I agree, and sometimes the men do not know what their role is and vice versa, and there's a lot of confusion, I know. It's like, who pays for the date? That's kind of how my experience has been lately. Anyway, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Some may feel that your book is a repudiation of God and religion in the traditional sense of those words. How would you respond to that perspective, and how does the material fit in with the religious beliefs of Christianity, Buddhism, Wicca, Hindus, New Age, and so on and so forth?
Well, personally, you know, I don't hold that any religion has a monopoly on truth. I've studied all of those faiths, and mm-hmm. I've participated and actively explored many of them. And I find that there is a core truth that shines underneath every one of the surface expressions. And that core truth is a deeper truth than the one that is more fragmented religion to religion. So I don't think that I am repudiating God so much as expanding my understanding of what the word means. I don't perceive God as a supernatural man being who is somewhere out there, not active and alive within every single one of us. I perceive, or if I were to define God, I would call God the infinite eternal life force that is active within all of life, within everything that exists, from every atom and molecule up to every complex living organism, including humans, and including planets and stars in the entire universe. So to me, it's the engine that powers the universe. You can call that God, you can call it life, whatever name you assign to it. It's that which our minds can't even comprehend, but out of which our minds have been birthed.
Interesting. Interesting perspective once again. I'll probably listen back to the show and find out more things. Okay, we hear this concept about self-love. Can you talk about that? It feels like a very, you know, nebulous concept. How can I make it real in my own life and our listeners' lives? How can they do that? We hear we should love ourselves, we should forgive. How can we do those things, Eileen?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important for people to recognize that we are conditioned as children from the very early age to judge ourselves, to criticize ourselves, to be harsh with ourselves, to be unkind. We create the superego, which is the inner judge, in response to the very first trauma we experience as a child. The first time an adult says we are bad, or we personalize being scolded for doing something bad, it's a shock to the human mind because it never occurred to us that we could be bad until somebody informs us. And that shock can be so compellingly painful to a child that the child then makes the decision, well, I better watch my own behavior, and I better scold myself first before somebody else beats me to it because it's too shocking and painful if I think I'm fine and somebody else tells me I'm not. So that's the birth of that split within ourselves where we create this harsh inner judge that sort of sits on the back of our brain and steps forward and talks to us in these really horrible ways. And most of us aren't even conscious of the way that we speak to ourselves, how cruel we can be to ourselves. We hear other people say cruel things, but we don't necessarily notice that inner cruelty. So when I speak of self-love, that's what I'm speaking of, is A, forgiving yourself for having been harsh and talked to yourself in ways that you wouldn't talk to another person. you know, if your inner voice is saying, oh, you're fat and you're lazy and you're stupid and you're never going to amount to anything, and why did you do that ridiculous thing? What's wrong with you? Would you turn and talk to a friend of yours in that fashion? No, but you talk to yourself that way. Mm-hmm. So I want people to stop that behavior by replacing it with a loving way of speaking to themselves, repatterning the way that they speak to themselves, which repatterns the way you feel about yourself, and that in turn repatterns the way that you address other people. Because mm-hmm. if you do have that harsh inner voice, even if you modulate it for external sharing, you still have a tendency to include that energy in the way you talk to other people because it's habitual. It's an unconscious pattern. So breaking that unconscious pattern and speaking to yourself lovingly empowers us to rise to become the best person we can be. Instead of browbeating ourselves or beating ourselves down, we are encouraging ourselves and fostering trust in ourselves, and that in turn translates to how we relate to others.
Yes, it's true, and I usually tell my clients it's about self-awareness and listening to the inner critic, like you just spoke mm-hmm. about. And sometimes we don't even know we're doing it. That's what kills me. It's like we don't realize we're doing that, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, you hear yourself talking to yourself, and you're like, oh, I wouldn't talk to my best friend that way. You're right. You're very right.
I actually recall the first time I heard that voice, and I was an adult. I was probably in my late 30s. Moving from one room to another in my house, and I don't remember what thing I had done that I felt was stupid, but all of a sudden, as I was walking, I thought, oh my God, there's somebody screaming at me, and I heard screaming, and I realized I was screaming at myself inside my own head, and it was the very first time I noticed that voice, and it was shocking. My gosh, why am I speaking to myself in that tone? And that was the wake-up for me, the awakening to how I was treating myself so cruelly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, be gentle with yourself, saying, I love mm-hmm. you daily. I mean, I love Louise Hay's mirror work, you know, saying, I love and approve of you, looking straight at yourself in the mirror with those eyes. And it's hard. Some people can't even do that.
Mm-hmm. One of the greatest exercises I ever did was at a workshop I attended. It was a woman's workshop. And we each wrote a love letter to ourselves, just doing that, changing the pattern. And we sealed it, addressed it to ourselves, put it in an envelope, and then the workshop leader mailed it to us a year later on the day that the workshop had ended. And to receive that letter in the mail from my earlier self and read these beautiful things I was saying about myself brought tears to my eyes. And I just think it's a lovely exercise for, you know, if you have a good friend, to make that pact and say, here, let's do this together and let's exchange letters, and a year from now we'll mail them to one another. But it's an opportunity to practice really being loving with yourself and then reminding yourself a year later or even a month or two later, you know, hey, I did this wonderful thing for myself and I want to keep that going.
You do, and you want to focus on what things are great about you instead of the negativity. I mean, there's so many, we could be talking about this for hours, but changing mm-hmm. that concept, especially when I got into personal work, you know, changing a lot of things about how I talk, not only talk to myself, but how what I thought about good about myself, the positive attributes, because we're always focused on the negative.
Mm-hmm.
We really are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Switching gears a little bit here, you seem to be offering a more inclusive definition of life than what modern science proposes life to be. How are you choosing to define the word, and why the change?
Oh, that's a great question. I had this really potent realization one day that it came to me that the definition that we set for what is alive and what is dead, we created this demarcation quite a few hundred years ago based on what we perceived as inert, like rocks and dirt and you know, chemical compounds, and then what we saw as actually in motion, like plants and animals. So the things that we didn't see changing, we assumed were dead, and the things that we were able to observe changing, we assumed were alive. Well, we didn't have access to electron microscopes at those times, and we didn't really understand the nature of organic chemistry and how that works in biology. So to the extent that we just drew this line in the sand and said everything on the left of this line is dead and everything on the right is alive, we divided the universe into living and dead. We created death by doing that. If we revisit that assumption and say, wait a minute, what makes a rock dead? Why is a rock or a table dead? If we take the electron microscope and we look at what is tabling or what is rocking, what we discover is it's a very ordered system that has a tremendous amount of energy going on. There's electrons that are moving and spinning in there. There's all kinds of motion. There is energy that is moving back and forth between, let's say, the table and the outside atmosphere. It will respond to its surroundings, not in the traditional sense of the word. It's not going to make a baby table because it doesn't have the same kinds of reproductive capacities that we have. But it's in conscious agreement. Every molecule in that table is in conscious agreement to be part of that table and to respond to its environment however it deems necessary. So eventually, if you watch a table long enough, it's going to dissolve into sawdust or whatever, and new life will spring out of it. So my understanding, or my perspective, is that everything is made of that same substrate, that same willingness to make bargains and compacts and order itself and exchange energy with the outside world and have this relationship and change itself internally. I mean, you look at a rock, you give it enough pressure, heat, and time, and a lump of coal will become a diamond. Who are we to say that's not life in action? We just sort of arbitrarily put that limit there. So if we take that limit off and say there's a range, all we're looking at are just ranges of life aliveness, and some aliveness has more consciousness or more self-awareness than other forms of aliveness. But when we gift life back to the universe, we gift ourselves the gift of everlasting life. There is no such thing as death. There is only change.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you just transition. You know, when you die, mm-hmm. your physical body leaves you, and you go back to spirit, to divine force. You know, that's what it is, and it's not actually scary. I've been there twice, so...
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's like taking off your clothes at night. We don't mourn the loss of our outfit when we go to bed.
No.
Nor do we necessarily rejoice every time we get up and put on clothes. It's just part of what we do.
Right. And there's such a fear surrounding that transition. And
right. And we've created it.
Yes,
yeah,
we
so
have.
It's time to change it.
It's time to change a lot of things. And I feel your book is going to help, you know, raise the consciousness of humankind. Definitely.
Well, that's all high right. praise indeed.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Let's go on to more, like, about compassion, forgiveness, and acceptance seem to be very important aspects of your book. Why are we to forgive ourselves, or what are we to forgive ourselves for? What are we to accept, and why are we so encouraged to feel compassion?
I think the most important thing for us to forgive ourselves for is our own ignorance, because the vast majority of us never deliberately want to do harm to anybody else or anything else. We lash out of ignorance, out of fear, the feeling of separation that was inculcated in us as children. And some of the things we then do cause harm because we're trying to protect ourselves from the outside world. We feel that separation.
Right.
So the forgiveness comes when we see that the things that we have done out of ignorance have caused inadvertent harm to others. Not intentional, you know, unless, you know, even if you hit somebody, you're trying to keep them away from you for whatever reason, unless you're an absolute sociopath, which is another story. There are some of those, and they deserve forgiveness too. So that's an important aspect of it, is recognizing we're not deliberately cruel or stupid or mean. We're just struggling to understand what we're in. As far as what we're supposed to accept, or what helps to accept, is the isness of what is. To simply be present with the aliveness of what our surroundings are, and to embrace the reality of what it is and not resist it. Which doesn't mean we can't change it. I think there's a misunderstanding that people have. A lot of people think that if I accept this moment as it is, that means I'm stuck in it forever. I'm never going to get out of it. So I'll wait to be accepting until I've made the moment perfect. Well, you can spend the rest of your life trying to make your moment perfect, but the moment is going to change with or without your consent. And so accepting the truth of that and saying, I don't need to be in resistance to what shows up. I need to be present with what shows up. And the more present I can be, the more aware I am of what the moment calls for from me, and the more energy I have to tap and wisdom to tap into the resources that I have at my disposal internally to bring into this moment what this moment is calling for. And I think most of the time what the moment is calling for is more love, more compassion, more appreciation, more understanding, more gratitude. So those things, more patience, more peace, more love. If we can bring those forward and move through the world, delivering those energies into the world with abundance, because it's not like we have to parse out love. I don't run out. I can love everything that shows up in this moment, even something that shows up as what I would label ugly or scary. I can love it. And when I do that, what do I feel? I feel love rising in me, bathing me with the sense of love as I deliver that energy into the world. When love moves through me, it kisses me first. And then from that state, I can respond to what is, even if it's ugly or scary.
Mm-hmm. And it usually is not as ugly or scary as you think it is when you go through it.
Exactly. When you love it, you find the things about it that are beautiful.
Yep.
You can actually look at something that was formerly ugly or frightening and mm-hmm. say, this is a beautiful moment. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know how it's going to end, but
yeah.
I can be here in this moment and be alive with it, and let's dance. Let's mm-hmm. dance on the edge of the unknown together, and we'll see together what happens. That's the whole story of life. Let's dance on the edge of the unknown together and see what happens next.
Exactly, exactly. And also getting back to compassion for self, there was a saying a friend of mine used to say, you didn't know what you didn't know until now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know,
and then we often forget, too. So that's where more forgiveness comes in, is you know something and you think you know it, but if it's not fully embodied, if you haven't mastered it to the point that it becomes who you are, but you're still in the process of converting that understanding to a practice or a behavior that you're fully embodying, there will come times when, you know, something will confront you and you go back to the old habit, because that habit had, you know, years and years and years of running through it over and over again. So that's where we turn in times of stress, is, you know, our ingrained habits. And when, you know, I do it, there are times I'll yell at somebody, or I'll, you know, think a bad thought about somebody, and I hear myself doing that, and I stop and say, oh, there's that separation again. There you're at it again.
Yeah.
Just let go. Look at mm-hmm. them. Find that loving center and reconnect if possible from that place.
Yeah, and sometimes the people that irritate us the most, and I've learned this throughout the years, is our greatest teachers.
Oh, yes, because they're the ones where we need the most practice. If that's where the triggers come in and the impulse to fall back on the habits we know come in. And you can use technology, again, as an understanding for how this works. If you get a new computer program and you're used to running an old one, and suddenly you're on a deadline pressure and you haven't learned all the ins and outs of how the new one works, are you going to do the work on the old program with all of its drawbacks, but you know it, or are mm-hmm. you going to take the time to really try to activate the new program? And if you're on a deadline and you feel pressured or stressed or afraid, you're probably going to try the old one because that's what has worked in the past, even though you know the new one's going to work better.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Change of habit. Sometimes it takes mm-hmm. 21 days to change a habit. Yeah. Sometimes it takes
yeah.
a lifetime to get practice self-awareness, you know?
Yeah. I think for me it really helps to remember that life is a grand experiment, that this experience we're having as human beings is a grand experiment. And we don't even know if self-consciousness is going to really take root in the world. I don't think it has rooted itself deeply in the cosmos yet. I think it's still sort of in the shell, the hard shell stage, and maybe the taproots are starting to stir and come down. But I don't think consciousness is, or the kind of consciousness we're talking about, which is advanced consciousness, will take root in the universe until we move through the self-consciousness, which is sort of like the stirring inside the shell of a seed, and the seed cracks open and the taproot comes down and anchors into the soil. That is us moving out of ourselves, that self-consciousness, which is so narcissistic, into rootedness in the whole. And when we do that, we become aware of so much more that's around us, that our taproots go into the soil of life, and we connect with all of the nutrition and nourishment and the sunlight and the warmth and the heat and the expression of nutrients that are coming from all around us. So we're on the edge of that, I think, wide crack of the shell for human consciousness right now. And every one of us that softens our own shell and starts to put out our own taproot, we are helping to anchor higher consciousness in the universe. That's our mission. It's a holy mission.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, definitely. Definitely. And there's a lot of spiritual materials out there, ranging from A Course in Miracles to Conversations with God. What need does this book compare? What need does this book compared with all the others? Wow, it's like I have a corkscrew in my mouth. It just keeps winding up. So
that's a great question. You know, I think it is in alignment with those other works. It certainly carries a lot of the same insights and wisdom. I would say the biggest single difference is what this book proposes is to invite the reader to move through a process of self-maturation of the inner consciousness through working through the four stages of the book, because there are four sections in the book. The first is soft love, which is life speaking to the reader the way that a mother would speak to a beloved child. And then the second section is called tough love, which is the way that a loving father would speak to a teenager that is struggling and maybe a little bit rebellious and resistant and confused and stressed. And then the third section, which is self-love, is the movement toward self-actualization, which takes you back to discovering what your unique gifts are. That's the whole purpose of self-realization, is to discover what am I bringing to the world that's different from anything anybody else has to bring, and how do I deliver. And then the last section, which is life love, says, you know, once you've got these great gifts that you're bringing forward and you've learned to love yourself and you've done some of the inner changes, the inner work, the challenges that were necessary to mature, how do you now interface with the rest of reality so that your gift can be best received in those places where they do the most good? Mm. So it's a process.
Oh, most definitely. It is a process. And, you know, the process takes, you know, the whole lifetime. Otherwise, we'd be 6 feet under.
Yeah, we're still here, so we're not done. That's the way
I have a long ways to go. I know that my guide showed me. I'm like, oh, great. Do I have some bad karma? They're like, no, it's all good. It's all good. I'm like, yeah, you're in spirit form. I'm here. Anyway. Yeah. I understand that you had a life-changing spiritual experience. Can you tell us about that experience? And because I see in the bio it says you had a spiritual awakening. Is that what you would call spiritual awakening when you're about to help?
Yes, I call it a spiritual awakening. I think the medical profession would call it a mental breakdown or a psychotic breakdown, because that was the way it manifested to others who were not inside my head at the time or my body. So it looked, for all intents and purposes, like a complete and utter mental breakdown. And I did experience, you know, tremendous psychosis. I was completely severed from the ordinary world during that period. But the process for me internally was really one of making a decision. The time was now. In that moment, I was ready to let go of all of the unexamined beliefs and assumptions that I had accumulated over the course of decades, literally decades. And I guess the best way I can describe it is I felt like as a child, I liked to do jigsaw puzzles. And I felt like I had built this frame, this beautiful puzzle frame where all the corners and edges were aligned and everything was perfect. And then I was out in the world gathering the internal pieces to fit into that frame. And the longer I played in the world, the more I realized I had a whole big stack of pieces that were sitting outside the frame that didn't fit. They didn't go in anywhere. There was no imagery or no section of the puzzle frame I had created that allowed for that information to fit. And I either had to keep building that stack of dissonant information, which created cognitive dissonance and deep confusion in my heart, or I had to explode the frame that I had created, which was too tight to contain the wonder of reality. So I blew up the frame. I literally imploded the frame and went back to zero. Nothing was true. I decided nothing I ever knew was true. And then from that moment forward, I had to decide what I knew to be true, not what I believed or what I wanted to be true, but really, truly what I knew to be true. And it was woefully little.
Usually when you think you know it all is when they blow it up in your face. That's what I notice with my spirit guides and angels. It's like, okay, Amy, we're going to just shake and rock your world. Oh, great.
Yep.
Thank you very much for that experience. And how do you think this has shaped your own personal spiritual beliefs and views?
Well, I think because my experience was so traumatizing. I mean, I had literally almost died. I was in intensive care for several days at the end of this experience and came very close to death. And then it took me a long, long time to move through. If you consider it like an earthquake, it was like a 10.0 earthquake. And then for the next 3 to 5 years, I had aftershocks that were, you know, 7.7 and 6.5 and 5.5. And it took a long time for that ground to settle. So my focus was making the decision. I never wanted to build. I didn't want to build a bigger, fancier frame that I was going to have to blow up down the road. I decided I never wanted to build a frame again. So my choice was to build a center, to turn my inner experience into like a maypole where I could take a ribbon and I could go out as far in any direction I wanted to go and go explore anything that looked interesting to me or that called to me passionately. And that if I ever felt like I was too far and I was lost, I just come back to center. So I'm now building outward from center in all directions in you know, 360 degrees, rather than trying to build this flat two-dimensional puzzle that will tell me the whole of reality. And as long as I can find center, I'm home.
Yeah, the center is, I call, the eye of the storm, which is usually calm, and then everything else around you is a cyclone. And if you can find that, it's amazing. If you can find that center in self, like you said, and I know after my near-death experience, my second one, it took me 2 years at least to find my center again.
Yes. It's challenging once you've lost that, the mooring, you know, rediscovering that. That's where the real work is. And then, you know, the storm that surrounds us has so much momentum and so much intensity and energy that you can be standing there as calm and still inside yourself as you can be, and then you stick a finger out, and boy, that thing will grab you and spin you around before you know it, and the next thing you know, you're back in the storm. So that's part of the maturation process as well, is learning how to maintain that really deep inner peace, even though the storm is raging all around you. And it doesn't mean you can't call on the energy of anger or the any kind of energy that's available to you, you can call on it, but you're calling on it from a peaceful state, from a still place, and that's the energy that you know is necessary in the world in this moment. So, you know, if somebody is coming at me with an Uzi, I'm not going to be all love and light and peace. I'll probably do something very defensive because I'm not ready to let somebody with an Uzi take me out because they're confused. But I don't have to do it from a place of hatred or rage at them, how dare they do this to me. I can simply see the isness of the moment. Here comes somebody with something that is dangerous. My choice now is to use all the wisdom and power at my disposal to simply stop that with the least amount of force necessary.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes, and I've studied this as well, about anger, how it can be very constructive and move us to change, or if there's something wrong, it alerts us to the fact that we're maybe being mistreated in some way. So
yeah, we're not here to reject any of our gifts.
Right.
And that's part of the challenge, is that some people feel like, oh, anger is beneath us. We need to leave anger behind. We need to leave fear behind. No, no, they're very useful in their limited capacity. What we need to do is get them back in where they belong and not have them be our constant go-to tools. They're tools that are used under very, very limited conditions in very, very small sets of circumstances. And we've got a whole other wide range of emotional wisdom and intellectual capacity available to us, short of those.
Right. It's learning how to work within the eye of the storm. That's what it is. And being, like you said, some people go back to those old habits of maybe being angry and just leashing their anger out instead of dealing with it. I mean, everything is a lesson. Everything, you're right, every gift, every emotion, everything we have is a gift from the universe to learn from and grow from.
Yeah. I stopped seeing it as a binary world some time ago, where it's either on, off, or right, left, or good, bad,
exactly.
Or good, evil.
Yes.
And I see it as like a speedometer needle, where we have this incredible range, a rainbow of responses that's infinite. If you look at a rainbow that goes all the way from, you know, infrared to ultraviolet, the color scheme in between is infinite, literally. We can go anywhere. We can move that needle anywhere. So the question is, how anchored is our needle at center? Where's the center point? And how are we dialing it in all the way from, you know, absolute rage over here to unconditional love? And somewhere in the middle, usually, is where the most appropriate response falls. So our job is to become a master of energy and learn where to dial in that needle in relationship to what's showing up in our world.
Exactly. Well, we're running out of time, and my final question to you is, briefly, are you working on anything new, and if so, what is it?
Ah, that's a great question. Thank you. I've got actually two books that I'm in the process of working on right now. The next one, which I'm hoping will be finished sometime next year, is called Dreaming Utopia, A Vision for a Sacred Society. And that's sort of an overview of some of these things I've been talking about. It's a more intellectual pursuit than Raindrops. It's more in line with sacred economics. And then the other one I'm working on is called Sacred Governance. So it's how to bring the sacred back into what we have profaned in our ignorance, not deliberately, but because we've labeled so many things dead, we've lost sight of the aliveness of the world, and then we don't have reverence for it. So I want to inspire people to bring themselves back into that state of reverence and feel the sacredness of what we are in.
Well, where can we find your latest work, Rainbows, Raindrops of Love for a Thirsty World?
It's available now on Amazon.com. I believe that if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can actually still download it for free. And you can certainly get it in paperback through Amazon. Any bookstore can order it as well. So we have a national distributor, Ingram's distributing for us. So you can go into a bookstore and order it if they're not carrying it. Ask for it, and they can get it for you.
Great. Eileen, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. It was a pleasure having you on, as always. Thank you. When your book comes out, let me know, your new one, and we'll have you on again.
Oh, that would be lovely. Thank you for having me and letting me have the opportunity to reach your audience.
Thank you very much. And everyone, this is Amy Toy for Angel Answers with Amy Toy. And catch us next week, Mondays at 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you very much.